This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib, and coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Osman Mahmoud, a 22-year-old from Mogadishu, has been found guilty of murder, sexual violence and multiple counts of torture on the basis of evidence and testimony from migrants.
That's Josephine McKenna reporting from Rome. We'll have full details coming up.
Also in Kenya, the country awaits word from the Electoral Commission on whether the rerun of the presidential election will go forward as planned. And results in Liberia's national election could start to come in late today as vote counting continues.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Kenya's opposition held rallies in Nairobi and Kisumu today as the country awaits word from the Electoral Commission on whether the rerun of the presidential election will go forward as planned. Opposition leader Raila Odinga's withdrawal from the race has pushed Kenya further into uncharted territory. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Thousands of protesters took to the streets in Nairobi Wednesday, following Tuesday's announcement by opposition leader Raila Odinga that he will not participate in the rerun of the election, set for October 26th. Odinga and his NASA opposition coalition argue that according to a 2013 Supreme Court ruling, their withdrawal means that the Electoral Commission, or IEBC, must cancel the polls and conduct fresh nominations, which should take place at least 90 days before a general election. Protester Jonathan Ogasso says he agrees with Odinga.
I think he has exercised his democratic right, which is enshrined in the Constitution of Kenya, and that, in essence, nullifies the election that was scheduled for 26th of October. So we are going back to a new election after 90 days. That's all we know.
But he may not know. The IEBC could decide to hold elections in 2 weeks as scheduled. The commission could also decide that President Uhuru Kenyatta is the winner by default. That option became more complicated Wednesday after the High Court ruled that Third Way Alliance leader Ekuru Aukot could run in the October 26 election, since he took part in the petition that nullified the previous one. Or the IEBC could agree with NASA's interpretation and instruct the parties to hold fresh nominations. Nairobi-based political writer and commentator Barack Maluka believes this option to be the most ideal path, saying that the Supreme Court's 2013 guidance should be followed.
And that way, we can be sure that within a period of just about 90 days, the country could put this thing behind it. Any other avenue, I see a lot of litigation, and I see a lot of delay and a heightening of tempers, and I see a lot of confusion on any other avenue.
Schaefer Okore is a program officer at political engagement organization Siasa Place. She agrees that the IEBC should conduct elections after fresh nominations, after they fix the problems addressed by the Supreme Court. And she urges calm.
The Kenyan voters right now, we need to all come down and start learning from the fact that our democracy is being pushed to grow and not being pushed for doom. I don't understand why people are so pessimistic about what happened. I mean, a presidential candidate withdrawing is not the end. A presidential candidate withdrawing should all wake us up to realize that there are loopholes still in our constitution, and these loopholes need to be addressed.
Kenya has been in electoral limbo since the original results were nullified on September 1st, due to what the Supreme Court called irregularities and illegalities in the transmission of results. Now, the country waits for the IEBC to say how it plans to proceed, in an electoral season that seems to grow more dramatic with each passing day. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A Somali man who tortured dozens of his compatriots and other migrants in a Libyan camp was sentenced to life in prison by an Italian court yesterday. 22-year-old Osman Matamoud was convicted of murder and multiple counts of torture on the basis of testimony from migrants. Matamoud has tried to pass himself off as a regular asylum seeker. In September 2016, he was arrested after being reported to authorities for using torture to extort money from migrants in a transit camp in Bani Walid, a town in the Libyan desert. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the sentencing and its significance for future cases.
Osman Matamoud, a 22-year-old from Mogadishu, has been found guilty of murder, sexual violence, and multiple counts of torture on the basis of evidence and testimony from migrants after he was recognized outside a migrant center in Milan. Now, he tried to pass himself off as a regular asylum seeker. He was arrested in September 2016, and the accusations have been incredibly shocking that he used torture, sexual violence to extort money from migrants when he ran a transit camp in Bani Walid, a town about 100 miles south of Tripoli in the Libyan desert. This was a very dramatic case where we saw 17 witnesses speak of how they had been raped, beaten or tortured by Matamoud during this particular trial in Milan.
How did they happen to arrest him?
Well, it was really by chance. And when some of the victims spotted him at this migrant center trying to pass himself off as a legitimate migrant, as a legitimate asylum seeker, instead he had tried to blend in and was arrested by fellow Somalis who were practically ready to lynch him before police stepped in and arrested him. He had crossed the Mediterranean in a boat full of migrants and had tried to pass himself off as one of them. So this was a very dramatic case and perhaps one of the few that have been followed through by the court system here. We know that there have been some accusations and some arrests in similar cases where alleged torturers, alleged sadists have been arrested after being identified by fellow migrants, but this is one of the first that have really been followed through to the end of the trial itself, and where we do have a very dramatic sentence here in this particular case.
As you said, this is very dramatic, a sentence of life in prison. So what is the reaction to that?
Well, I think there's a sense of relief from the victims. One teenage girl told Milan prosecutors how this man had come into the location where she was waiting in Libya, how he grabbed her, ripped off her clothes and raped her in front of other migrants, and said that she had been raped several times. So these people, these victims have gone through a horrendous experience just trying to reach Italy. And the chief prosecutor, Ilda Boccassini, who has spent her life fighting the mafia, said that in a career spanning 40 years, she'd never seen such horrors. So this is really going to be seen as a landmark case and perhaps send another message to others who might be thinking of the same sort of behaviour in dealing with their fellow migrants who are seeking a better life, fleeing Africa and trying to reach Europe across the Mediterranean.
That was Josephine McKenna speaking with me from Rome.
Results in Liberia's national election could start to come in late today as vote counting continues. Liberia's 2 million registered voters had 20 presidential candidates to choose from when they went to the polls yesterday. If no candidate wins more than 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff election in November. The top two contenders are football star George Weah and incumbent Vice President Joseph Booki. The winner will replace Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first female head of government. She served 2 6-year terms, leading the country in its recovery from decades of civil war and from the Ebola crisis that began in 2014. Voting was largely peaceful, although there were reports of ballots arriving late at some polling stations, problems with identifying registered voters, and people being unable to vote after waiting long hours.
The deadly unrest this month in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions is prompting renewed calls for dialogue to end the nearly year-long crisis. The government continues to draw a hard line on separatist movements. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Human rights groups and analysts say the government's crackdown in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions continues to inflame tensions. It's been nearly a year since activists in the two regions began agitating for greater autonomy. Some are calling for independence. Pierre Baligel, the leader of the UPC, Cameroon's oldest political party, says the government should bring all actors to the table.
Three types of actors. You have the people who want the secession. They want to create their own state. You have the people who want to come back to federalism. And you have the people who want to stay in a state which is united but decentralized.
Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, has not ruled out dialogue, but the president has said that he will engage in no talks on the form of the state. Biya says Cameroon is one and indivisible. Troops remain deployed following large pro-independence protests in the English-speaking zones on October 1st. At least 17 people were killed by security forces in the unrest, according to Amnesty International. The government says investigations are underway into the army's conduct. However, authorities rejected calls this week from Christian leaders that they release all people detained over the crisis and drop charges against others in exile in order to ease tensions and pave the way for dialogue. Government spokesman Issa Chiruma says groups advocating for reforms to the state should use the political process.
Let SCNC form a political party. We are of opinion that the huge majority of our population, of our people, would like to come back to federalism. How do you know this if you do not consult through electoral process the people?
A return to federalism was among the reforms proposed by English-speaking teachers and lawyers when they began their strike last November. The crisis quickly deepened as separatist groups began calling for full independence, but the core issue remains the same: the alleged marginalization of English speakers in the majority French-speaking country. Vekijika Fanso is a prominent history professor at the University of Yaoundé. He recommends open dialogue followed by a referendum in the Anglophone regions.
How do you call somebody a terrorist who has no arms, who is marching with peace branches? It is not because some people say we want the form of state changed that he should dismiss them, arrest them, and lock them up.
A referendum appears unlikely. It must be called by the president, and the last time Cameroon held one was in 1972. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Kenya, the country awaits word from the Electoral Commission on whether the rerun of the presidential election will go forward as planned. And a Somali man who tortured dozens of his compatriots and other migrants in a Libyan camp was sentenced to life in prison by an Italian court. And results in Liberia's national election could start to come in late today as vote counting continues. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The International Labour Organization is urging private enterprises to invest more in workers and promote innovation to stem rising joblessness around the world. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva on the launch of the ILO's World Employment and Social Outlook 2017.
Global unemployment this year stands at more than 201 million. This, says the International Labour Organization, is an increase of 3.4 million compared to 2016. The ILO study reports private businesses account for nearly 3 billion workers, or 87% of total global employment. It says a strong public sector is the foundation for growth, job creation, and poverty reduction. Deborah Greenfield is the ILO Deputy Director General for Policy. Greenfield says investing in workers is a key to sustainability. She also says providing formal training for permanent employees results in higher wages, higher productivity, and lower unit labor costs. Greenfield says temporary workers are at a disadvantage.
But intensified use of temporary employment is associated with lower wages and lower productivity without achieving any gains in unit labor costs. The report also finds that on-the-job training is an important driver of innovation. Since temporary workers are rarely offered training, this might also affect innovation in firms in a negative way.
The ILO report says in some cases, innovation has led to the hiring of more temporary workers, mainly women. It notes, however, that while this might be beneficial in the short term, long term, it depresses wages and leads to lower productivity because of the instability of temporary work and lack of benefits. The report, however, finds innovation increases competitiveness and job creation for enterprises. It says innovative firms tend to be more productive, employ more educated workers, offer more training, and hire more female workers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nine of the worst countries for girls trying to get an education are in Africa. In a new study, the One Campaign, which seeks to reduce poverty, says South Sudan tops the list of the 10 worst countries. Afghanistan is the only non-African nation on the list. Education activists say getting girls in school has lifelong benefits for girls and their communities. It reduces child pregnancy rates, improves the health of the mothers and their babies, and helps lift economic growth. Alice Jouet is the education policy manager for the One Campaign. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the report.
Can you give us a short summary of the report and your findings?
The report really talks about how girls are missing out of school at a higher level than boys in 10 countries in particular. South Sudan came out as number one, Central African Republic, Niger, Afghanistan, Chad, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Liberia, and Ethiopia. And what you'll learn from that is that 9 out of 10 of those countries are in Africa, and they are all fragile states. So we're really wanting to kind of shed light on the importance of recognizing that these are the toughest places for a girl to get an education.
Now, is the problem getting worse, or are you seeing in your study improvements, maybe not in these 10 countries, but in some of the others?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, since 2000, the number of girls missing out on school globally fell steadily, and then it stalled in recent years. And actually, the latest data in 2015 marked the first time it started moving in reverse. So we're actually seeing a rise in the number of girls out of school now globally. So that's obviously really concerning for us. So what we really want to do is have 2018 be the year of turning this around. So it starts with the Global Partnership for Education replenishment in the early next year, which we're hoping will have a really big impact on the number of girls that are missing out in school.
What has caused the reversal?
That's something that it's hard to know. It's going to be really interesting as well to see the 2016 data when that comes out and find out what's happening there. We definitely need to see more investment in education that's definitely tailored off. So we need more global and domestic investments in education. I think that will really make a strong difference as long as it's coupled with reforms.
Well, what are some of the other things that the international community as well as local communities can be doing to get children, particularly girls, into the classroom?
We've actually got a set of policy recommendations on this, which we call Make Education Work for Every Girl. So there are four key areas for this. breaking every barrier to girls' education, so having national governments assess the barriers that are actually keeping the girls out of school and then learning once they're in school, investing in every teacher, so bolstering teacher training and support, monitoring outcomes and data. I mean, one of the big findings of this report are big data gaps in education data, and we really, really need to invest more in data and disaggregated data. And then connect every classroom, so the use of technology, internet, and ways of reaching marginalized communities that are outside of traditional classrooms, as well as within classrooms.
That was Alice Jouet, the Education Policy Manager for the One Campaign. She discussed the organization's report on education for girls with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson in Washington.
A new study finds obesity among children and adolescents between 5 and 19 years of age has increased tenfold over the last four decades. The global study by the Imperial College of London and the World Health Organization reports obesity in this group has increased from 11 million in 1975 to 124 million in 2016. Once again, we go to Lisa Schlein, who reports for VOA at the launch of the report at WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Data show obesity rates in children and adolescents have soared globally over the past four decades and continue to increase in low and middle-income countries. But the study finds levels of obesity have slowed and plateaued in the richer countries, though they remain unacceptably high. In 2016, it finds obesity rates were highest in Polynesia and Micronesia, followed by the high-income English-speaking region, including the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, and Britain. If current trends continue, authors of the report warn global levels of child and adolescent obesity will surpass those from moderately and severely underweight or malnourished youngsters by 2022. These problems remain acute in Asia and some parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Fiona Bull is Program Coordinator for Surveillance and Population-Based Prevention of Non-Communicable Diseases at the World Health Organization. She says effective, inexpensive measures to curb childhood obesity are available. These interventions include regulatory and fiscal policies.
The regulations in the areas of restricting marketing, consideration of fiscal policy such as taxes, and food labelling policies, giving consumers clear information about the contents of food on the front of pack, like their salt, fat, and sugar content. These regulatory processes, awareness raising, are core population public health approaches to ending obesity.
Bull says children should be encouraged to spend less time playing games on the internet or watching TV and more time engaged in physical activities and sports. She says obese children are likely to become obese adults, and they, she says, risk premature death from obesity-related diseases, including heart disease, diabetes, liver disease, cancers, and strokes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the Grace Hopper Celebration. The conference is the world's largest gathering of women in technology. We'll recap the events in Orlando, Florida, and speak with African women working in the industry in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere for their perspective on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time
with David Bandy.